Greetings, this is Nigeria Anderson, and you're with UrbanBuzzMag.com, and I have Mr. John Stein on the line with me, and he has a new album out, and it's his 19th album called Next Gen. Well, John, let's talk about this new album, but first I want to know, you are truly an acclaimed guitarist, author, you have many hats, but I read that you've been playing the guitar since 7 years old. Can you just tell us, how did you become interested in the guitar at 7?
Thanks for asking the questions, Nigeria. At 7 years old, I had been playing piano. My parents gave me piano lessons the year before, and I liked it. I liked it at first a lot, but as I got farther into it, after about a year, you know, I started to resist the... I guess I was resisting reading the music. She was teaching me like an old-fashioned piano teacher, reading little things on the piano. And I don't know, I just stopped liking that somehow, and I wanted to try something different. And I asked for a violin, actually.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why. And my mother said no. I don't want to listen to that. Which I don't understand that really, but instead of a violin, she gave me a little toy guitar, basically, or a, you know, a small person's guitar.
Okay.
And so it really came from my mother, because I think I asked for a violin. That's my memory. But in any case, she gave me a guitar, and I liked it better because there's something about the guitar. At least when you first start playing, you know, you learn a few chords in the open position, which is what most people who pick up the guitar, they pick it up to accompany their singing, and they learn a few simple chords. And I took to it, and it didn't require a lot of visual reading stuff. I was just more into the music somehow internally, and I didn't want to be looking at the piece of paper. Of course, I learned to read, and I learned all kinds of academic things about music later in my life, but at that stage in my life, that was more interesting for me than the piano was. And I was very fortunate because I had a fabulous teacher. She was a woman who, at the moment that I met her, and when she was my teacher, she was interested in folk music, but she was really a classical vocalist.
Oh, wow.
She had been trained as a real, you know, classical singer. And later, she got interested in folk music. She took some guitar lessons and learned to play the guitar pretty well herself. And then she was performing as a folk singer at the time. And then later in her life, I found out that she went back to giving vocal lessons because really what she was a singer, not a guitarist. But in any case, she got me started, and because she was performing herself, she started giving me opportunities because I guess I was really an avid student and loved it and did really well. So she had me performing occasionally with her in performances, and I learned folk guitar from her, really. And at the time, I could sing. I had a nice voice as a kid, and I could sing. She taught me folk music in all these different languages. It was just a really wonderful experience. It gave me a great deal of self-esteem to get this woman helping me and presenting me. It was just a great start in music. She also taught me some basic fundamental things about the guitar, the notes on the guitar. You know, a lot of people learn to play some grips on the guitar, but they don't learn to play, they don't really even know what notes they're playing, or they learn to play a chord and they know where the grip is and they know where the root of the chord is, but they don't even know what the other notes are.
Come on now.
She got me started on really learning the instrument a little bit too, which was really nice. And so that's how I started at 7.
Right.
Now I'm an old guy now, so it's been a lot of years.
Yeah, we're going to get there, because you're definitely skilled, talented, and definitely paid your dues to talk your talk, as we say. The guitar to me and the piano are like key instruments that most people really like and kind of learn on. I like it because I think they're definitely top instruments you can use to just do solo songs or do your own thing. They're not so loud like a horn or a sax, and they provide the rhythm and the grooves that you need to flow to. Now, you mentioned the violin. What made you kind of even tap in or be interested in the violin?
I have no idea. Do you remember that I thought, well, I'm going to do something else. How about a violin?
But okay.
I don't know how much thought went into it.
Okay.
And I was just as happy to change instruments to the guitar, and I'm really grateful, in fact, that I did. You know, I had my younger daughter, who's now a mature old person who has children of her own, but when she was young, we got her hooked up with a woman who taught her Suzuki violin, so I ended up helping her throughout her youth learning to play the violin, and the violin is a superb instrument as well, you know. But I'm kind of glad that I didn't do that, because as you just mentioned, you can sit there and play guitar or piano, either one, and you're the band.
Right.
You know, a violin is a little hard to do that. You can play chords on a violin, but it's not the same. So, you know, a violin almost requires you to be playing with other people.
Right.
A lot of people learn to play music in school, also horns and stuff. And not only is it they're loud, but, you know, a horn can't really accompany him or herself while they're playing as easily. So I'm very grateful that I play the guitar. I just love the guitar. I've loved it all my life. I mean, I fell in love with it when I was introduced to it at 7, and it's just been my greatest companion, really.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Other than the family, my family. So
yeah.
There you have it.
Yeah, and excuse my limited knowledge of guitarists and jazz. I'm only familiar with, like, Norman Brown and George Benson and Stanley Jordan. And now, of course, I know John Stein. So as a guitarist in jazz, what is that community like? Because you said you started out with folk, and then you ended up in jazz. Talk to us about that community and that transition.
It used to be a major thing. You know, jazz music was the popular music of a certain era. That was many decades ago, 80 years ago. You know, in the 1940s, at the 30s and 40s, throughout World War II, it was, in a sense, the popular music of the day. You know, my father grew up listening to jazz music,
right.
The big bands, and he knew all of that stuff and loved all that. And that's the generation before me. That's my father's generation.
Right, right.
But, you know, starting in the 1950s, although jazz was still big then, and into the 60s, it started to change, and rock music overtook it, really, and it's no longer the popular music of the day. So if you're asking about the community, you're talking about people like myself, who are dinosaurs, really, because we're interested in a music that if we had been alive in the 1940s, 30s, 40s, it would have been the popular music, and it would have been what every musician was, this popular musician, not classical music, but popular musicians would have been aspired to do. But it's no longer that, because it's not as popular. It's a niche now.
Okay, yeah.
Music. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I know a lot of jazz musicians, a lot of my fellow teachers at Berklee College, and in New York, there's a lot of jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, all of us are playing a kind of music that's no longer generally popular. So it's a strong but small community,
okay.
Because we're not the people you mentioned have reached a broader audience.
Right.
The ones
right.
that you've listened to. George Benson, because he's a great jazz musician,
right.
But he's also a pop musician, and he's reached out to make music that the general public, not just real jazz heads, can appreciate. And that's true of all those people that you mentioned.
Right.
They're people who've reached a broader audience. And I've never tried to do that personally,
right.
Because I'm so interested in the mainstream. There's so many different types of genres within that small four-letter word,
right.
That it you could be talking about New Orleans kind of Dixieland music. You could be talking about avant-garde music that, you know, the average person wouldn't understand at all, because it's just a cacophony to them. And then there's mainstream jazz, maybe. There's bossa nova the Brazilian music has greatly influenced North American jazz, so that all those Latin styles
right.
are now folded into jazz as well. Cuban jazz, Brazilian jazz, it's all part of jazz. And it's an interesting thing, because I've had an opportunity a little bit. I haven't pursued it a great amount, but I've gone to Europe to play music, and I've gone to South America to play music. And it used to be that being a North American jazz musician was something special because, you know, it was invented here and it's an American style of music. Mm-hmm. But now people all over the world have learned it and can play it.
Right.
So it's both a blessing and a curse for a musician. It used to be more special for an American to show up in some other part of the world. It was special for the people there. It was a big deal. Now
right.
It's not so much. So that's the disadvantage. But on the other hand, you know, I never established myself as a touring musician where I could bring my own musicians with me. I always went someplace and then played with local musicians. And so now it's a benefit for me because when I do that, the local musicians are excellent. They're as good as the ones, in many cases, as the ones I would play with in this country. So you can find great musicians everywhere now.
Right.
And that's a blessing. So
right.
it's got both of those sides of the coin, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you have 30 years of recording, so you've gone through all the genres. But how do you use all the skills, talents, and abilities and sounds, all the albums that you've put out from beginning to now as we move to your new album, Next Gen, to mash up the John Stein sound?
Well, you're asking a very interesting question. I'm not sure I know the answer to it. You know, it's very interesting to me because I feel like I could have worked harder.
There's a
certain amount of laziness in me, you know. I mean, I have to admit this.
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd rather sit here and play stuff that I'm comfortable with than force myself all the time to learn something new.
Okay.
But in fact, that aside, I could have worked a little harder. But in fact, if you want to know the truth, ever since I got bitten by this jazz bug, I haven't stopped studying.
Okay.
I mean, I studied every musician in all the subgenres of jazz that I was interested in. And at first, I had a narrow range of music that I liked, and over the years, my range of music has gotten broader, so that there are certain styles of jazz that initially I didn't like, but now I do.
And okay.
I studied all the musicians in those styles. I studied the guitar players, of course, because I'm a guitar player, and I was trying to learn what I could from them. But I studied all the other instruments as well, and I've read a million books on jazz. I have had a huge library of books. Biographies of musicians and histories and critiques and essays. I mean, I have studied like crazy over
right.
all these years.
Right.
And then every day I sit and I practice, and I'm retired now from teaching.
Right.
So I have a lot more practice time, which is a blessing. And I sit here and I'm refining my touch and the way I play. I always feel like I'm working on things that have been hard for me, and I'm trying to get better at them. You know, I could have worked harder. I said that up front, but in fact, I have worked really hard, and now I've been doing it since I went to Berkeley when I was 30, and I had started practicing jazz styles, you know, several years before that, and now I'm in my 70s. So
right.
you can see I've been doing it a long time, not to mention all the 30 years of music I had been doing practically before then.
Right.
So, you know, it's a lifetime's worth of accumulation of music. And all of that teaching I did, you know, teaching is a really fabulous thing. And, you know, a lot of people end up teaching because that's how most musicians these days make a living.
Right.
It's really hard to make a living as a performer. I mean, certain people do it. Taylor Swift does it.
Right.
She makes a pretty good living. but the average musician, and not just the average musician, almost all musicians don't make the kind of living Taylor Swift makes.
Right.
So, you know, you end up having to do other things, and I've been fortunate that the other things I do are teaching, and it's what most musicians do if they're not working in some other field and just playing music on the side. So at least allowed me to stay focused on music, you know, basically all the time, even though what I was doing most of the time to make a living was teaching.
Right.
But in any case, teaching, some people resent it. You know, some musicians become teachers because they have to make a living, but they really don't enjoy it. And I was lucky because I actually loved it.
Right.
I loved it because I loved the students. I loved my colleagues. It was just a lot of fun for me. I mean, I hated the politics of the school. Right. All schools are full of politics. You know, every higher education school, people are trying to get ahead of somebody else.
Right.
And all the politics are really stupid. And there were certain times when I was really caught up in that and I hated it. But if you look at the big picture, I absolutely loved my experience as a Berklee College of Music employee. The teaching I did, and I loved it, especially when I helped people, because, you know, some students are like I was when I went to college the first time.
Right.
In other words, they don't work at it, and they don't really know what they're missing, and they don't care. And that's something you have to deal with if you're a teacher. Not every student really cares and works at it.
Right.
But when you get a student who, especially the students who initially don't get it, and then all of a sudden realize how important it is, and they start working and they do well, I lived for those moments. I really enjoyed helping the students that made hay with what I was offering them. But at any rate, I'm losing track of why we're even talking about this. What was your question?
The mashup of the John Stein sound.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, very good. Thanks for reminding me.
No worries.
So, anyway,
Tell you something, John. We are where key players speak. So, you're a key player, and we speak on whatever you want to speak on. So, go for it.
Okay. Okay, good. I'm not going to talk about politics, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, no, don't do that.
I don't want to talk. Anyway, I can tell you an interesting story. Here's an interesting story. And I've released a lot of records. As you said, the one that's coming out next week is number 19. The following one will be my 20th record. But I've had it in the can all these years, and I'm not sure exactly why. I had a long-time affiliation with a particular record label, the Wailing City Sound record label, which is located in New Bedford, Mass. And that man who owned that record has been a great supporter for me. His name is Neil Weiss. He owns the record label. He's like a person who, he's just a supporter of the arts in South Coast of Massachusetts and Rhode Island. And he, all the local musicians down there benefit from him in various ways. He promotes gigs, and he has this record label, and he puts out their music. And the music business is bad, so I have to say, I think he's sort of stepping away from the music business. So I had to find another way to release this new record. Like, you're interviewing me now for my newest record, which is being released. Story. The reason I'm telling the story is he put out 14 or so of my records. I'm off the top of my head, I think it's 40 exact number. But over a 20-year period, you know, he put out all this music, and he spent I don't know how much money promoting my music, and I am greatly indebted to him. But in any case, this record that I made, I recorded it myself in my living room.
Okay.
In the 1990s. And he wasn't interested in it, so I never did anything with it. And so now I had to find a new way to release this new record. So I showed him, the person who's releasing it, I showed him the other record that I had in the can, and he also likes that. So it's finally coming out after all these years. But here's the reason I'm telling the story. You know, as I told you, I've been a relentless studier and practicer, and I'm working like crazy to try to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm getting better.
You are.
And then I listen. Yeah, I am. But I'm telling you, I'm listening to the music I made 30 years ago, and I sound exactly to my ears like I sound now. So I don't know what that means. It just means that I've absorbed more and more, and it's more and more who I am. But I was as good 30 years ago as I am today, which is mystifying to me. I can't explain it at all.
Well,
very interesting.
That's your sound. That's your mashup, the John Stein sound. If you was good then and you're even good now and you have your sound, that's your sound. And I've watched your YouTube channel and listened to you play, and you are really good. I'm not just saying that to say that you're really good. So kudos to you.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for that nice compliment. And you're absolutely right. You know, here's the thing about music, and this style of music particularly, but I think it's true in all styles. maybe not quite as much in classical, but in class, because everyone in classical is playing something that somebody else composed. So you could hear six different versions of the same piece, but they're still going to be different.
Right.
Because everyone brings their personality to the performance, even when they're playing somebody else's notes.
Right.
Like in jazz, you know, it's largely improvised. And so, you know, it's really easier to see someone's personality, maybe, in jazz. But
right.
even in classical music, if you listen to six different versions of Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, the tempos, the groove, the vibe, the way certain phrases come out of the fingers on the piano, I mean, everyone plays it different. So what you're talking about for artists is an artist has to find their own voice.
Right.
And it's interesting to me. I feel like I'm refining myself, but I've had the same voice for all of these years, and
right.
I don't know, that doesn't change. So I guess that's really what the message is.
Yeah.
And if you don't find that, you never become a consequential musician. You have
wow.
to find your own. Because music is an art form, and what is art? It's people expressing something to other people in a deep way that they can relate to one way or another. So you have to find, if you want to be a great musician, painter, sculptor, whatever, filmmaker, photographer, anything in the arts, dancer, you have to find your own personal way of expression. So,
wow, I love that. Okay. So let's get on Next Gen Jazz.
Okay.
For Next Gen Jazz yeah. for My Grandchildren. You teamed up with Ed Lucy and Mike Connors. Let's get into the connection and this project. That's
okay. It's good. Let's get off the one that hasn't showed up yet and talk about the one that's here now. So here's the story. You know, I started playing with these guys. I retired in 2020.
Okay.
I was planning to retire from Berkeley after all those years, after the spring semester of 2020. And of course, 2020 is when COVID hit.
Right.
So fact is, because I was getting ready to retire, I was used to going to Berkeley it used to be 4 days. Finally, it was 3 days a week. And I wasn't going to have that, and I was worrying. My family was worried, what's he going to do when he retires? He's going to be at loose ends. I mean, I wasn't as worried about it as my daughter was. But I did kind of worry about it. I've got to replace all of this somehow. I wanted to retire in order to play music instead of talk about it all the time.
Right.
So I started looking for gigs, local gigs. I had actually just released a record that year that I had recorded in Brazil, and I could have gone on, I was planning to take that on tour in Brazil. I could have gone back to Brazil and toured that record. The fall semester and into the winter, as we were getting close to the end of my time as a teacher at Berkeley, I was successfully finding a few local gigs. And then COVID hit. We got to midterms in the spring of 2020 at Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
and I graded all the tests, and they sent us home. There's always a week off after midterms before you come back to finish the semester. Well, we never came back because of COVID.
Right.
And all the gigs I had
got canceled.
Every single one of them canceled.
Yeah.
And the tour in Brazil, no way. So
yeah.
Everything came to a stop. So, you know, I did spend the rest of the semester finishing my teaching on Zoom, which was interesting. I'm really grateful that it was my last semester and I didn't have to do it again. I didn't mind it that semester because it was bittersweet because it took a lot longer to learn how to do it on Zoom. And
right.
Get students' feedback on Zoom. It was way more time consuming. But since it was my last semester after all those years, I didn't even resent it. It was kind of a blessing in a way. Plus, we were stuck at home with nothing else to do. So what else was I going to do besides sit on my computer and figure out how to give students feedback?
Right.
But at any rate, I'm glad I didn't have to do it after that. The next year, if I'd been still teaching, I really would have hated it. But in any case, that's what I was doing. But I also I was retiring in order to play music. So how could I play music during? Well, what we did is we resorted to playing outside a lot once the weather got nice. We ended up playing in backyards, on back porches, and driveways, and mostly it was duets. I had a number of bass players that I would do duets with or whatever, just to play music, just to stay active. I did that a lot. The only sessions that I had that summer that had more than just a bass player were, I had been playing a few of these local gigs that got canceled with the drummer Mike Connors. He was willing to play that summer. Mm-hmm. And I said to him, well, who should we use as a bass player? And he said, well, I've been playing a lot with Ed Lucy. Let's use him.
Okay.
So that summer, every week almost, we got together on Mike's back porch and played some tunes together. Mm-hmm. And the only gig that didn't get entirely canceled that summer, I was supposed to play a live gig in New Bedford for Neil Weiss, the man I mentioned who owned the record label. He has the fiber optics business. That's how he could afford to be a label owner. Because his real business wasn't selling jazz records.
Right.
People don't buy them, unfortunately.
Lord.
But he promotes a lot of concerts, and he had scheduled me to play a concert. You know, he lives in New Bedford, and in New Bedford, Massachusetts, the first Thursday in every month, at least in the nice weather, they have what they call an aha night, which is where local venues have put on shows or something in order to get traffic downtown so people will, you know, visit their downtown and buy stuff.
Right.
But Neil would put on a concert every aha night, and we were scheduled in August to play this. It got canceled because there were no outdoor concerts. But instead of canceling it completely, we went into the art museum in New Bedford, which has big high ceilings,
mm-hmm.
and we sat very far apart from each other, and they hired a videotape person to capture our performance as if we were playing a concert. We just pretended like there was an audience.
Right.
There wasn't.
Right.
And we just played. We played two sets of music with a little break in between, and this is for broadcast on the AHA Music, the New Bedford's Facebook page.
Okay.
So that's the only thing that we had the entire summer that wasn't just a casual session on somebody's backyard. And the story of that is that the guy they hired did a really good job. He's a professional sound man. He works with a big rock band. If I think of the name of the band, I'll let you know.
All right.
He travels a lot as a sound man, but he also does videotaping, and he's also very good at engineering sound. So he did a really good job videotaping it and capturing mm-hmm. the sound. And they sent me the videotapes to watch of us performing, and it was two sets of music, and I liked it. But, you know, when you're watching yourself on video, you're looking at the expression on your face and your body language. And,
right.
You know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's a little embarrassing. So I wasn't thrilled by it. I liked it. I thought it sounded good, you know. But, and then one day I was, that summer later, or early fall, I was in my music studio. And I thought, well, I'll clean up my music, tidy up some stuff. And I put this on. And it was playing, but I didn't watch it. It was just playing as music while I did something else.
Right.
And I started hearing this, and I thought to myself, oh, my God, I never imagined I would ever be able to do a live recording and it would sound good enough I'd want to release it.
Oh, okay.
You know, no chance for overdubs, no chance to fix any mistakes. It's just what it is, you know. But I realized this music is so good, it needs to come out as a CD, you know, without the video. Who cares about the video?
Right.
This is a good CD. So I convinced the guy at the record label, Neil Weiss, to release it, and we titled that one Serendipity because it had never intended to be a recording. It was just something we did for this videotape. So anyway, that's when I started playing with those guys. Thing, but I got sick and I was out of commission. I didn't know if I'd ever play again. I was so sick that I could have died and almost did in a way. So finally got home to my house after being in the hospital. One of the people that came to visit me quite often was Ed Lucy. And I couldn't even play. You know, when I got out of the hospital, after 2 months in the hospital, I had lost all of this strength. I had lost 40 pounds of muscle mass. I hadn't seen my guitars in 2 months. My wife brought my guitars down and put one on my lap, and I couldn't even hold it. I didn't have the strength to hold it. Yeah. And I couldn't even press the strings down. I didn't have any strength or coordination in my hands, my fingers. So that's where I started. But Ed kept visiting me. He'd just come over to be supportive, you know.
Right.
You know, he lives not too far away. He would come over. And one day I was feeling better, and I had been working on the guitar. You know, it wasn't devastating. I kind of knew that it would come back, but my strength would return.
Right,
my skill
right.
would return. So I kept working at it, and it got gradually better. And then one day he was visiting me, and I said, maybe we should try playing some music together. So I went upstairs where I have a bass here of my own, and Ed used my bass, and we actually played some tunes together. And believe me, I didn't have a great deal of skill yet.
Right.
My fingers didn't do, they weren't doing what I was telling them to do exactly.
Right.
But my God, what a thrill it was for me to play, because all of that time, I hadn't played any music with anybody else.
Right.
And I'll tell you, Nigeria, there's something really special about when you play music with somebody else. It's kind of like a train. It's kind of like, you know what, here's a metaphor. It's like when the hobos in the 30s or the 20s and 30s were crossing the country, jumping trains to go across the country. It's like you're standing there and the train's going by and you jump on the train, and as soon as your feet touch the boxcar or whatever you're jumping into, suddenly from being immobile, suddenly you're going with the train. The train's taken you.
Right,
right. In other words, you don't have any control anymore. Suddenly you're going from nothing to wherever the train is going.
Speed, right, right.
And so there's something about that. That's what it's like to play music. When you're playing music with somebody else, the two of you are creating this motion that the train is doing. And it's not something you did. It's something that's happening, and you're on this train ride all of a sudden. I hadn't experienced that in months. And I mean, it was a long time. I think it was probably, I mean, the 2 months I was sick, and then quite a few months before I was able to start playing again, really. Maybe it was 6 months before. I hadn't experienced that. And that feeling, as soon as we played the first tune, even though my fingers weren't really working yet, that feeling came back. I realized what it felt like to be playing in that sort of mysterious groove with you're creating with somebody else, and it's such a thrill.
Yeah.
It was one of the biggest thrills of my life, I have to tell you.
Yeah, I mean, jazz, when you think of jazz, you always think of like the jam sessions where there's this harmony of musicians coming together playing their own sound, and collectively it just organically you're just like, oh my God, that was hot, and then you can't even reproduce it if you tried.
That's the thing about music. You know, the other thing I did to make a living earlier in my life was carpentry, and I loved it. I learned to build houses for people and do all the woodwork, the finish work and all that stuff. And there's something, some kind of pride you get for building like a staircase. And you do a really good job, and you look at it, and there it is, and you know it's going to be there a long time.
Right, right.
And it's beautiful, and it's going to be there a lot longer than you, perhaps.
Right, exactly.
Like, for example, my house is old. The person who built the house is probably dead now.
Right.
But here's the house, and I'm living in it. You know, so
that's what,
but music is completely different, man. Of course, recordings last. That's a little different. But when you're actually playing music with people, the notes go off into the air and they disappear.
Right, right.
And you can't get them back. You can't go back and look at them again. So what you described, that jam session where that hot feeling comes, you know, the next time the same musicians get together, it isn't going to feel the same no matter what. It could be better, but it could be worse. But it's never going to be the same, you know.
Right. So now Next Gen Jazz for my grandchildren. When I first saw it, Next Gen, of course, the next generation introducing to your grandkids jazz. And what message and sound were you trying to provide for your grandchildren?
Well, I'll tell you the story of Next Jam. So here's the story. So I did the record Serendipity I told you about. Then I got sick. And when I got sick, I had been preparing to record another record. And I had the music all prepared, and it was rehearsed, and I was making calls to schedule the studio. And then I got sick, and it was a year later that I could do anything before I was ready to do it. So the first thing I did after I recovered and prepared again a second time was to make another record, the record that I'd been planning to make before I got sick.
Right.
So I make the record, and it's, you know, I guess it was my 18th record. It was my 18th record. It's called No Goodbyes. I'm proud of the record. I'd been working on it now for a lot of years because I had prepared for a year before I got sick, and then I was delayed a year, and then I had to prepare again. So it was almost 3 years in the making, which is pretty unusual for me.
Right.
So I have this record, and I'm proud of it. And among other things, I give copies to my family. And I have two daughters, and each of them has kids. And I give the record to one of my kids. And, you know, after you've spent all these years making records, and it's your 18th record, it's not such a big deal anymore to people in your family. It's like something I do. They just think, oh, it's what he does. He makes records. Big deal.
Right.
So I give the record, you know, to one of my daughters, and she goes, oh, nice dad, ho-hum. You know, I mean, I didn't resent this, but she goes, nice dad, but when are you going to write some music for your grandchildren? So I had just spent all this time and energy making this record, and instantly I realized, okay, on to the next one. Here we go. I had to do another record. So I had to write some music and name it. So, I mean, I've already written music named for each of my children. I have one named for my wife. I have every dog that's lived in the family has a song named for it. But I didn't have any for my current, I have five grandchildren. I didn't have any for them yet.
Right.
So she was right. I needed to write something and name it for my grandchildren. So that's what this record is. And I'll tell you an interesting thing about it. In a lot of era of jazz, there are a lot of jazz composers who wrote their own tunes. And so there's a whole jazz repertoire is filled with standard tunes that jazz musicians like to play, and it's also filled with tunes that jazz musicians composed themselves. Some of the most famous tunes in jazz were composed by the jazz musicians, not other kind of composers. So anyway, I needed to compose some songs for these kids, and usually when I write music, I write the song, and I'm thinking about all these musical the groove, the form of the tune, the harmony, the melody relationship, you know, all these musical factors is what I'm thinking about. And then after I write the tune, I have to go off and search for something to title it. And actually, the title has absolutely nothing to do with the compositional process. It's just something to get stuck on it later. So that's how 99% of my songs were written. But this was different because this time I had the kids' names and the kids' personalities, and I tried to write music that represented in some way what I knew about each child.
Right.
And not only did it affect me compositionally, but when I play these tunes with people, who do I think about? I'm thinking about the kid as I play it. And so the personalities of the children in some way are related to the music in a way that most of the time my music isn't related to the title. And I found that very interesting. And it's actually a blessing for me. I love my grandchildren. Every time I play these tunes, what am I thinking about? Well, I'm thinking about all those musical things, but I'm also thinking about the kid. And to me, that's just a beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's such an honor.
So anyway, this music on this record isn't real. It's just jazz music.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I'm writing music for children.
Right.
You know, at their level, it's the kind of music that a jazz musician might listen to and appreciate. But it does have the personalities as much as I can put those personalities into the music. It's got them. And the record has, I have five grandchildren, so there's five tunes named for them, and the rest of the record is made up of songs that I like to play, just like any other record, you know. And they're not songs I wrote. They're covers of other people's music.
Oh, okay.
Jazz standards.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us. As we say, once a key player, always a key player. So as long as you continue to put out music, make sure you consider UrbanBuzzMag.com as one of your media outlets. And tell people how they can get a copy of Next Gen Jazz for my grandchildren and your social media.
Okay, so, yeah, my social, well, okay, that's good. I mean, you can find me on Facebook.
Okay.
You could find me on Instagram, but I have to admit I never really learned to use Instagram. So really I use Facebook. And I have John Stein music page and just the John Stein page. My main page is just John Stein on Facebook. And I have a website, which is johnstein.com, johnstein.com.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, if you want copies of the music, hard copies, actual CDs, you have to do that. The distributor that's really, the record label that's really doing this record is distributing it digitally only. So the hard copies have to be purchased off of my website. But you can find the music, we've released four songs early. Today is actually release day of the fourth single ahead of the record. And the actual record is going to be available on all of the digital platforms starting January 31st, which is the end of next week.
Okay. All right, then.
I want to say, before we tidy this up, I just want to say thank you, Nigeria. You've been a really fun person to talk with. I hope that what I've shared is interesting. And I really appreciate your questions and your interest. Appreciate you.
Thank you. I'm honored. I appreciate you as well. And thank you for that compliment. And, you know, we're here for the artists, and that's what's important. So, like I said, we are where key players speak. There's no time limit. We want to just, you know, let you tell your story. It's yours.
Well.
All right, then. You have a good day.
Thank you. Appreciate you. Bye-bye.